This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
So our topic tonight is smartphones, and I've called this Skills for Being Human in a Smartphone Culture, which sort of sounds like it's heavy and gravitas to it, maybe. But I want to start with a quote from a comedian who, when I first thought about this, I thought this would be great, but since then he's sort of publicly disgraced, this guy Louis C.K. So I know there's like a sign anyway. But this was from 2013. He was on the Conan O'Brien show, and I thought of playing it as a clip, but there's some... He says other things. This is a slightly edited version. So, but he's answering the question on why he doesn't want his kids to have a smartphone. He has two daughters. And it's sort of also answering the question of why people text and drive. So I'm going to read through it. I can't read it in the same way that he says it. But I think it's actually quite insightful. So answering the question of why people text and drive, Louis C.K. says, because underneath everything in your life, there is that thing, that empty, forever empty, that knowledge that it's all for nothing and you're alone. It's down there. And sometimes when things clear away and you're not watching and you're in your car, you start going, oh, here it comes. I'm alone. And it starts to visit you, this overwhelming sadness. Life is tremendously sad. That's why we text and drive. Pretty much 100% of people are driving and texting. They're killing and murdering each other with their cars. But people are willing to risk taking their life and ruining others because they don't want to be alone for a second. Because we don't want the feeling of sadness. We push it away with our phones. Instead of ever feeling completely happy or completely sad, you just feel kind of satisfied with your products. And then you die. So that's why I don't want to get a phone for my kids. Louis, prior to this comment, also said, you need to build the ability to just be yourself and not be doing something. That's what the phones are taking away. The ability to just sit there, that's being a person. So it goes without saying, I disagree with a number of Louis's points. He says things a little... hyperbolically, but I think he picks up on something, that the problem with smartphones goes significantly deeper than just managing our devices, that it goes deeper within all of us as people. And it actually goes back, these problems of living with ourselves go back before people even had smartphones. So that's a... Anyway, so I want to start with two disclaimers. The first is that there is a long and hollow tradition of cultural reflection which sort of falls into the category of kids these days rants, kids these days with their skateboards, kids these days with their smartphones, the get off my lawn approach to social engagement. And that is not what I'm after tonight. There's not a simple or sufficient narrative to place blame on millennials or digital natives. I don't want to scold anybody or wag my finger at anybody. This is an issue that affects people old and young alike. I'm also not anti-technology. I'm not anti-phone. I have a smartphone in my pocket right now, and I use it. So I need to say those things. I also need to say this is not necessarily about you. It could be about you, but I don't know if it is. This is not a covert way of drawing to bringing to attention your own smartphone habits. And the final disclaimer is that if you do struggle, like a lot of us do, with living well with our technology, especially smartphones, this lecture in and of itself is not a silver bullet. It's not a cure-all. Our phones habituate we get habituated to our phones. We get stuck on our phones, and I think just a lecture isn't going to solve that problem. But it can be helpful. It's helpful to reflect, to think about this thing. And so as a culture, we are giving an unprecedented amount of our time and money and attention to these devices. A 2016 study from the New York Review of Books found that we look at our smartphones every 4.3 minutes, the average American, which means by the time this lecture is done, the average American would have looked at their phone 10 or 11 times. The editors, the tech editors of Time Magazine, called the iPhone in particular the single most influential gadget, not invention, but gadget of all time. It has fundamentally changed our relationship to computing and information, a change likely to have repercussions for decades to come. And a large part of that change is the manner in which we're able to consolidate so much of our lives onto these little devices that fit into our hands. And that happens primarily through the ever-expanding reach of apps. People probably know the it's now like a famous thing. Oh, there's an app for that. There's an app for that. There's an app for that. From communicating with friends to banking to shopping to logging our latest craft beer consumption to charting our Bible reading to the fish we've caught this year to playing games with friends around the world to finding a ride home to learning the constellation, the list goes on and on and on. There's an app for that. There's an app for everything. And my colleague at the English Library, who I've never actually met but I've corresponded with, Josue Reichow, if I said his name correctly, he calls this aspect the lordship of the iPhone over all of life. And he goes on to comment, he borrows a line from the French philosopher Jacques Ellul, who said that one of the central features of modernity is a response to every situation in the world and a technique to solve it. That's what apps are doing. They embody that. And a theologian named Alistair Roberts, he's commented that being constantly connected to our own lives via our personally curated apps, he says this functions less as a purposeful action than as a continual state, part of the unconsidered and ubiquitous wallpaper of our contemporary existence. So what I want to do together this evening, I'm going to speak for a while and then hopefully we can have a conversation. I want to consider the wallpaper. I want to look at the wallpaper together. And I have to limit my reflections because there's so much written. There's so much coming out about smartphones, about this sort of technology. So, but this is how I've limited. This is where we're going to go tonight. I'm going to give three reasons of three possible. There's many more reasons of why people are stuck on their phones. They're going to be acedia, which if you've never heard of, we'll talk about that. The appeal of the ideas embedded within our phones, and then something called persuasive design. And then after we do these three reasons why, we're going to do these three skills to be human, things that help us live well in a smartphone culture. The first is going to be solitude. The second is intergenerational relationships. And the third is go for a walk. So that is where we're headed tonight. And so we're going to start with why people are stuck on their phones. And the first one is internal to us. It is a human problem. And this might be a new concept to some people, so I'll spend a little bit more time explaining what this is. This internal dynamic that has been called acedia. Maybe you've heard it referred to as sloth, the vice of sloth or laziness. Sometimes it's referred to as the noonday demon. And when one hears of sloth and laziness, we tend to think of sweatpants, and couches, and Netflix, and fingers covered with Dorito dust, and just like all that sort of stuff. But that's not necessarily the type of laziness that acedia is trying to diagnose. Though physical laziness can be a manifestation of acedia, acedia is a deeper human reality, a spiritual dynamic that touches on who we are. And it's a kind of a complex concept, so we're going to take a little bit of time with it. But it comes to us via 4th century Christian monks, sometimes called the Desert Fathers, and their teaching later became crystallized in the Seven Deadly Sins tradition. These were men, and there were women as well, who for different reasons, some legitimate, maybe some illegitimate, fled the comfortable life of early Christendom. This is the 4th century. And they chose to live radical lives of prayer, asceticism, and hospitality in the Egyptian desert. They thought as Jesus went into the desert, Jesus went into solitary places, they were following him out into the desert. An essential part of their work was being attentive to the ingrained, patterned moral behavior, which through time and repetition become part of someone's nature. And that leads them either to a life of wholeness, of integration, on one hand, a life of virtue, or a fragmented life, on the other hand, a life of vice. So we have virtue, integration, and wholeness, or we have fragmentation and vice. These monks were looking at the spiritual dynamics which often lie undetected beneath many of our day-in, day-out habits. And these were not people who are just mere or sort of simply moral hypochondriacs. They weren't just looking deep in to sort of continually assess themselves. They realized the first step to overcoming a problem is realizing what the problem is naming the problem. And so acedia is one of these problems people have, one of these vices. The word literally means absence of care. Acedia, not caring. And it's not just a slothful laziness in life in general, but it's laziness at love. What this woman, Rebecca de Jong, in her book Glittering Vices, which is an interesting book on the seven deadly sins, she refers to acedia as resistance to the demands of love. She says it's a state of internal sadness or sorrow because the good life is hard and takes attention and takes effort, takes work. So here's how the realization of this plays out. This is how one monk from the 4th century, a guy with a wonderful monk name, Evagrius, that's just like, if you meet a monk, like, that's a great desert father name. Anyway, Evagrius, he describes acedia with the following. And it's worth noting, he speaks of acedia as a demonic attack on the monk. So he says, first of all, this is our friend Evagrius. First of all, the demon of acedia makes it appear that the sun moves slowly or not at all, and that the day seems to be 50 hours long. Then he compels the monk to look constantly toward the windows, to jump out of his cell, to watch the sun to see how far it is from the 9th hour at the end of the day, to look this way and that. And further, he instills in him a dislike for the place and for his state of life itself and for his manual labor. He leads him on to the desire for other places where he can easily find the wherewithal to meet his needs and pursue a trade that is easier and more productive. He adds that pleasing the Lord is not a question of being in a particular place, and he deploys every device in order to have the monk leave his cell and flee the stadium. So at the end there, the fleeing the stadium of Evagrius is comparing the life of a monk to sort of an athletic competition. And we could have a long discussion on the legitimacy of sort of hermits living in the desert. But wherever we land on that, I think there's something for people here. Living out our Christian vocation, whatever it is, living into the demands of love, it doesn't take long for us to realize it is difficult. Love takes work. Love takes attention. Love takes being in a particular place with people. Our friends, our family, our coworkers actually might not be kind. They might not be kind to us. They might not be the sort of people we want them to be. They could misunderstand us. Our love can go unnoticed, unappreciated, unreturned. And so instead of digging in deeper, we back off. We become fidgety. We become lethargic. We become tired. We become slothful. So this is true whether you're a monk or you're a stay-at-home mom, a politician or a pool boy, a lawyer or a lawn care professional. Realizing that the good life, the work that God has called us, wherever it is, requires love and takes an amount of work and consistency. And so the slothful person sees that that's too much and gives up and becomes lazy at the demands of love. So acedia can either, it can look different ways too. And so can either look like a despairing resignation, apathy, laziness, giving in early, or a desperate escapism. avoidance, hyperactivity, busybody, always running here and there. Another monk with a less monkish name, a guy named John Cassian, he mentions these two poles of despairing resignation on one side and desperate escapism on the other. And he says this, the true athlete of Christ, who wishes to engage lawfully in the struggle for wholeness, for being an integrated person, must contend on both sides against this most wicked spirit of acedia, so as not to be cut down by the sword of sleepiness, nor to be drawn out from the bulwark of the monastery and depart in flight, to run away, even for a seemingly pious reason. So acedia, not caring, resisting the demands of love, kind of flips Tennyson's words around. It is better to never have loved at all than to have loved and lost, because love holds the possibility of loss and disappointment, and it takes work. It's too much work. I'd rather not do it. I'd rather stay in. Ancient Christian writers describe this internal state with other words, like sadness, restlessness, sorrow, resignation, self-disgust, because the good life is hard and you choose not to live it. You choose either to avoid it with despairing resignation or desperate escapism. And either one of these impulses can become habituated, perhaps unconscious strategy for distracting ourselves from the truth of our human predicament, where we are, who we are, and what we're called to do, if we want to be the type of people we aspire to. So instead of stepping into the hard work of our own lives, when we're faced with the friction of dealing with difficult things, we step away into lazy disengagement or frantic distraction. This is what acedia is diagnosing. And these are two things that our phone conveniently offers in a single place. But I wanted to begin here with acedia because I want to emphasize the difficulty of living in a smartphone culture, or the problem with it is a problem with us. It's a problem with me, and it's a problem with you. It's a problem we have as sinful people. There's all these internal dynamics that things like our smartphone just can take advantage of and use against us. So I wanted to start there, something that's internal to us. But moving on, I want to look at a second reason why people are stuck on their phones, and that's the appeal of the ideas embedded within our phones. So cultural critic Neil Postman, this is a picture of him right there, looking very distinguished, writes in an interesting essay called Five Things We Need to Know About Technological Change. He says this, embedded in every technology, there is a powerful idea, sometimes two or three powerful ideas. These ideas are often hidden from our view because they are of a somewhat abstract nature. But this should not be taken to mean that they do not have any practical consequences. Postman goes on to say, to the man with the hammer, everything looks like a nail. And we can extend the truism, Postman goes on, to the person with the pencil, everything looks like a sentence. To the person with the TV camera, everything looks like an image. To the person with a computer, everything looks like data. Now, Neil Postman said this in 1998, long before our moment of digital technology. And it's a fascinating question. What might be the powerful ideas or idea which are embedded within our smartphones? And I'd love to hear people's thoughts during the question and response time later. But I want to propose just one, and that is the idea that we can be in two places at the same time. We can be at two places at the same time. Now, this is, of course, not an actual reality for anyone, because we're always already embodied, regardless of what we're doing on our phone. When we're online or FaceTiming a friend or a relative who lives on the other side of the globe, we're always already in our bodies. We can't escape our bodies. We remain where our bodies are. Yet perhaps our phones would like us to think otherwise, that we can be here and somewhere else, which is an appealing offer, and it's an amazing gift, if you think about it, in some ways, of modern technology. It enables me to talk and text in real time with my brother, who lives in Florida. God bless his soul that he is in Florida. And before that, he lived in the Czech Republic. It's an amazing thing that we can communicate because of that. But this can become problematic, this appeal to be in two places at once, especially for human development, when we hold it up against the backdrop of acedia, this desire to escape, this desire to resist the demands of love where we actually are. So the phone in our pockets don't force us to do anything, but by its presence we're nudged away from our current place, where we could be bored, lonely, anxious, uncomfortable, to somewhere else where we don't have to deal with these less than pleasant parts of human experience. My phone effectively offers me an easy way to displace these experiences of inner dissonance almost as quickly as they arrive upon my internal landscape. I see this at the playground, where a parent is simultaneously watching their kids, playing with their kids, but scrolling through Instagram. I see this when people are texting and driving, avoiding that forever sadness that's coming to overtake them. They're both in their car, but they're communicating with someone somewhere else. Or it happens in my own life when I'm giving my daughter a bath, but I'm actually reading the new David Brooks editorial that just came out, which is really important. Or at least I tell myself that. I'm not saying these are all equally moral failures, but they're a failure to be present where we are, to be in one place, to be where our body is, even if it's uncomfortable or less than desirable. And our attention and our presence becomes divided. So MIT professor and writer on technology, Sherry Turkle, says this, and this is a wonderful book, Reclaiming Conversation, very helpful book. She's a very clear writer, very thoughtful person. But Turkle says this, when people say they're addicted to their phones, they're not only saying they want what their phones provide, they're also saying they don't want what their phones allow them to avoid. The thing I hear most is that going to your phone makes it easier to avoid boredom or anxiety. But both of these may signal that you're learning something new, something alive, something disruptive. You may be stretching yourself in a new direction. Boredom and anxiety are signs to attend more closely to things, not to turn away from them. So this idea that we can be in two places at once, while it is appealing, it fragments our attention, and it insulates us from boredom, but it also projects an open dismissiveness to any other people that are in our proximity. Divided attention is, in the words of theologian Oliver O'Donovan, a typical expression of disdain, by which he means a failure to love our neighbor, a failure to love the person or the people in closest proximity to where we are. And that is central to a Christian ethic of love. Loving our neighbor means loving those who are in proximity to where we are. There's more to say on the ideas embedded within our phone, but we're going to keep moving. So we've talked about acedia, we've talked about the ideas embedded within our technology that we're not always aware of, especially being in two places at the same time. And the third is called persuasive design. This is another matter that's internal to our devices. So if you think about it, the largest tech companies out there aren't worried about branding or marketing. It's rare to see them advertise. And that's because in large part they've made loyal customers through habit-forming experiences. Now, I apologize because I'm going to mispronounce this gentleman's name. Nir Eyal has written, he's a business prof at Stanford. He comments on his book, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. He says this, the cold truth is that the best products don't always win. Many times it's the products that have the ability to keep users coming back and using them without conscious thought. What Facebook wants to create an association with is every time you're bored, every time you have a few free minutes, this is a solve for that itch. The internal trigger is boredom, and the external triggers are these notifications. Every time someone posts something and you get that little jewel icon on your phone, it says to check Facebook. And these jewel notifications are really interesting because app creation is not just the domain of programmers or designers who have aesthetics or functionality in mind, but it's also the domain of those who are familiar with the brain science of addiction and attention. This is what's called persuasive design, which in the words of Ramsey Brown, who is a designer at Dopamine Labs, which is a real place, it's a fascinating place. You should Google it after you leave this lecture. But he says that this is designed, with the intention to harness parts of our brains which are responsible for forming habits and addictions. Brown, who co-runs this firm, is a programmer, but he also holds advanced degrees in neuroscience. So it's worth repeating, apps and computer interface are being designed by people who study the science of addiction, or bringing that into the app design. So take, for example, the dot, dot, dot. If you have an iPhone and you're texting someone else who has an iPhone, this is not a text that I have sent. It says, want to go for a run? I would, but I just left my house to grab a smoothie. It was the first thing that came up, and I was like, this is ridiculous. This can't be real. But this is what shows up while you're waiting for someone to text you back if you both have iPhones. And it's a clever way to keep you on your phone waiting for the simple reward of someone responding to your text. Brown says that at this moment, at least two things are going on neurologically. There's a small amount of stress response because you're waiting for a thing to happen and you don't know which way it will go. And he says there's a small dopamine release in anticipation, which is going to bring you back and use this chat interface more. Brown goes on to say that if you give people a sense that a reward is coming, they'll stay. They'll keep looking at their phones. It's the slot machine effect. Brown comments also on why so many of notifications on our apps are in the color red. That through both our brain wiring as well as cultural adaptation, we notice reds because they tell us to stop, to pay attention, to be careful. And seeing red on our phone means a little bit of the stress hormone cortisol is released when either we hear a notification or see this badge. It neurologically reinforces the need to resolve it and get the red to go away. It's a little creepy hearing this guy talk about this design. In a real sense, your phone or the people standing behind your phone know more about you than you do. They know more about how your brain works than you do. And they need to know that because they're trying to make money. The more we look at our phones, the more advertisers give apps money. There's so much money to be made here. Sherry Turkle quotes one of her students that says, her student says to her, "We are not as strong as our technologies pull." And then Turkle says there is a seductive undertow to our digital media. And a large part of that is because it's designed just to do that. So there's a lot of reasons why people look at their phones all the time. I think three of them can be, one, internal to us, this dynamic of acedia, resisting the demands of love. The second, internal to the device, the appeal of this idea of being in more than one place at once. And the last is that apps are designed to keep you looking at them and to keep you returning to them. The amount of time we spend on our phones isn't neutral to our growth as people. In fact, as more and more studies from various corners of research that I'm not going to quote tonight because there's an overwhelming amount of research out there, showing that our phones are playing a decisive role in our struggle to live well with ourselves. There are studies that connect phone use with teen sex rates, with loneliness, with attention span, with levels of anxiety, with suicide rates. Via our phones, we're not just wandering online or connecting with our friends. Our minds and our persons are being captured and divided. So it's something worth talking about. And I'm going to change directions and start talking now about skills or virtues, things we can do to develop ways to live well with our technology. But before we do that, I want to have a brief advertisement for a wonderful book on this, a book that has a lot of tips. I'm not going to present as many tips as this book does. It's a very practically minded book, a very wise book called The TechWise Family by Andy Crouch. And he'll give you some advice such as this, to take digital fasts regularly. Take an hour a day, take a day a week, and a week each year to disengage from your phones and from screens in general. He encourages you to have your devices go to sleep before you wake up. Oh, and they wake up after you. Have tech-free creative spaces where you can engage with some activity and not be distracted by just the presence of your phone. And then also, I'm not sure he says this, but buy an alarm clock. So, what's that?
Put an alarm clock here so you can explain.
Oh, people need to know? Well, we can do a question and answer. Actually, just Google it. Just figure it out. Ask Siri to tell you what your alarm clock is. What an alarm clock is. So, at this point, I want to look at three virtues. The first is solitude. The second will be intergenerational relationships. And the last will be to go for a walk. So, and as a way into talking about solitude, about learning to be alone with yourself, especially as a space for reflection and an integration of your life, I want to consider, take a long run at getting at this by looking at a very fascinating book by a woman named Donna Freitas. She is a professor at Notre Dame. She works a lot with Christian Smith. If people know Christian Smith, he's a famous sociologist. But she's written this fascinating and admittedly depressing book called The Happiness Effect: How Social Media is Driving a Generation to Appear Perfect at Any Cost. And this book is, it tells about her traveling across the country, visiting university campuses to see how technology functions in the lives of emerging adults. She has a lot of interviews. She also takes a lot of surveys. And early in the book, she laments that the goods of social media are being eclipsed by the image consciousness and professional concerns of young adults. She says that social media is teaching them to place guards around their vulnerability, and it enables them to become masters of filtering away the bad, the sad, and the negative. It's worth just repeating again, because so much of this is sort of on the negative side of things. She does see that there is some good to social media. Those goods are being eclipsed, though. But central to her research was the relationship between social media and the importance or the imperative of appearing happy. In fact, 73% of the college students she surveyed answered yes to the question, "I always try to appear positive or happy with anything attached to my real name." And this is the first component of her theory, which is the title of the book, The Happiness Effect, which she says is the following. Young people feel so pressured to post happy things on social media. Most of what everyone sees on social media from their peers are happy things. As a result, they often feel inferior because they aren't actually happy all the time. So it creates this vicious cycle. Someone doesn't feel good. They know what will make them feel good is likes on a social media post. So they post a picture of themselves being happy. They receive the likes. They feel better. The problem is their friends see them being happy on social media, realize they're not happy, and so what they do is they create a post of themselves being happy on social media, and it goes on and on and on. This is the "I want to feel good, therefore I post" impulse. And this creates a pretty superficial dynamic in a lot of ways. One of the students that Freitas interviews remarks that social media is, and these are her words, kind of like what everybody says with their high school reunion. They want to go back and show off how great their life is. It's like that now, but you don't have to wait for your 10-year reunion. It's like that every day. Perpetual high school reunion. That is the most unappealing thing ever to me. Oh my goodness. But Freitas documents the phenomenon of how these students strategize to maximize the numbers of likes on a post they might receive by posting at quote-unquote high traffic times when people are most likely to be on social media. She quotes another student who says the following. "People used to do things and then post them. And the approval you gained for whatever you were putting out there was a byproduct of the actual activity. Now the anticipated approval is what's driving the behavior or the activity." There's been this reversal. So Freitas' research also looked into the pressure of not just appearing happy online, but perfect, or what's been referred to as the professionalization of social media. So while 73% said they always want to appear happy, 79% of the students she interviewed responded with a yes to the statement, "I am aware that my name is a brand, and I need to cultivate it carefully." So the students that she interviewed were quick to differentiate what they perceived to be more permanent online platforms like Facebook or Instagram with more temporary ones, which are like Snapchat or this thing called Yik Yak, which I never heard of before reading this book. And on these, the permanent platforms, which would presumably be viewed by employers or school admission boards, they would brand themselves with great deliberation, even doing what's called a social media cleanup. Has anyone heard of a social media cleanup before? It's the process of removing from your profile anything that would make you not look great. So that includes the following: any negative emotion, any posts where you might appear mean or have picked a fight, any posts that express opinions about politics or religion, any post that might have potentially inappropriate photos, anything that might make you seem silly or boring, and worst of all, any posts that reveal that you are irrelevant and unpopular because these posts have few or no likes. So there's numerous places online to find out how to do one of these, and in fact, many of the universities she visited offered seminars on how to do a social media cleanup. But Freitas was dismayed because there was a general absence. They were offering these seminars, but there was an absence of any critical analysis on the role of social media in the lives of young people. And so this imperative to appear happy and the professionalization of their online lives became the development of a character, an online persona, that had little bearing on whether or not an individual is developing character, becoming a certain type of person who can do things in the world well. And so Freitas believes that there is an implicit yet extremely formative lesson being internalized here by the countless youth she interviewed. And it was this: that you should always be somewhere else, or more sinisterly, you should be someone else. This makes the inevitability of being alone with oneself not a possibility for discovery, reflection, or integration, as difficult as those have always been for people. But being alone with oneself is a frightening reality. So Frida's students described to her their perception of being alone primarily through the word fear. And so this is a story from her book about one of her students. So a student shared with her what it was like to watch snowflakes falling on the window. She's in Notre Dame. There's a lot of snow. It's the Midwest. The student noticed how beautiful the snow was, the way it piled up and crystallized. He also noticed how peaceful he felt watching it. But then suddenly, in the silence and stillness of being alone, other thoughts began to intrude. Bigger thoughts about his life and what he was doing with it, or even more worrisome, what he was not doing with it. He began to feel a conflict as the uncomfortable collided with the beautiful and the serene. He was upset about his impulse to suppress these thoughts by grabbing his phone, which he did, because if he'd been on his phone, he might not have ever been able to have had these discomforting thoughts. So Freitas is concerned that via social media, young people are learning to shut out these sorts of things, and they're learning it not even aware that they're being taught it. These moments, these feelings, the ability to be alone with oneself and reflect on the shape of one's life. Again, Freitas laments, "We are putting up a shield around our vulnerability. When my student spoke of watching the snow fall against his window that day, of reveling in its beauty and then recoiling from what this moment of stillness evoked in his mind, he was really talking about recoiling from himself." Theologian Paul Tillich offers a helpful distinction that I found in Sherry Turkle's book. He says that language has created the word loneliness to express the pain of being alone, and it has also created the word solitude to express the glory of being alone. Now, the glory of being alone doesn't make it easy. As Adele Calhoun in her Handbook of Spiritual Discipline says, we can feel agitated, scattered, and distracted in moments of solitude. These disconcerting feelings do two things for us. They reveal how much our identity is embedded in a false sense of self, and they show us how easy it is to avoid solitude because we dislike being unproductive and unapplauding. unapplauded. Sorry, end of quote. So young people on social media have more documentation of their own lives than any other people in human history, arguably. But it's also arguable that they've been given significantly less resources to know how to integrate these otherwise disparate, isolated moments of Instagrammed happiness within a broader, more complex, more human story of their lives. So the practice of solitude as a space for reflection and integration, to be able to tell the story of one's life and not just document it, becomes an important skill to learn, as difficult as it is to do it. And this is in part why it's important for people stuck on their phones, for young people on social media, to have relationships with people who are not stuck on a screen. And perhaps they can find that in an older generation. So I think the second skill is intergenerational relationships. And as a way into this, I want to talk about chronic anxiety. All of this social media pressure exacerbates anxiety. And while we imbibe the incessant stream of angry tweets from both sides of the political aisle, we get the impression that the world is spinning wildly out of control, like it never has before. But then we scroll through Instagram, and we see that everyone else's life is peaceful, serene, beautiful. It's got those cool filters, and there's always like great shadows and sunlight. And everyone else's life is wonderful. So it's not easy to know how to reconcile these two seemingly unreconcilable things, especially on a gut level. And so people are becoming anxious on both fronts. People are living with what Pastor Mark Sayers refers to as a digital nervous system. And part of that digital nervous system is imbibing chronic anxiety. And so chronic anxiety is a designation that comes from a psychologist named Edwin Friedman in this book of his. And it's anxiety that's more in the air. We breathe it more than it's in one soul. He's not talking about an individual's, in part in individuals, but more of a social reality of anxiety. So Friedman was a family systems therapist, a rabbi, as well as a government advisor. And he wrote that this atmosphere of chronic anxiety, this is a quote, might be compared to the volatile atmosphere of a room filled with gas fumes, where any sparking incident could set off a conflagration, and where people would then blame the person who struck the match rather than trying to disperse the fumes. Now, Friedman, who passed away in 1996, long before the dawn of the smartphone age, wrote that cultures with chronic anxiety, whether it's a religious culture, a government culture, a family culture, because he worked in all of those places, they have many issues, but at least five characteristics. So the first one is reactivity. This is characterized by you statements. People who are either argumentative or just completely passive, but people that are reacting. They're not acting, they're just responding all the time. The second is herding. People run in the same sorts of circles as people who are just like themselves, and there's always a condescension to the most immature people in these circles. The immature people set the tenor. The third aspect of chronic anxiety is blame displacement, which he says is shifting culpability outside of one's herd and the inability to harness inner strengths to address weakness and take responsibility, but instead point fingers. The next aspect is a quick fix mentality. This is a deep-seated impatience that looks to technique and fact-based methods to solve things. And then the last thing is poorly defined leadership, by which he means people who can't step out of these other four patterns. To me, this sounds like Twitter or the comments on almost any website, you know, whether it's YouTube or Facebook or something. This sounds familiar to me. But what I appreciate about Friedman's work is not so much his diagnosis of a culture of chronic anxiety, but what he puts forward as a helpful remedy. So again, having worked in families, in religious communities, and the government, Friedman found that one of the most effective means for dispersing the fumes of chronic anxiety was not knowing the right facts or mastering a certain technique, but presence. Presence. in particular the presence of what he calls well-differentiated people. These are people who bring a non-anxious presence. Friedman saw that no matter the system, in times of crisis, these five characteristics create relational toxicity, emotional regression, and fragility. Anxiety in these moments is in large part a relational issue. It's a social issue, more so than just an individual's anxiety, though of course an individual is part of relationships, part of society. And anxiety becomes contagious. And so I picture this sort of anxiety as though, as a culture, we're all flying on a plane, we're all afraid of flying, and there's a lot of turbulence on this flight. We're just trying to get through the flight. We want to go home. We want to go on vacation. We want to get to our meeting. But then, boom, the president tweets something, and there's turbulence in the plane. There's all these bumps. And then we try to shake it off. We watch the movie. But then our phone dings again, and it's a friend who's doing some wonderful thing in some wonderful place without us. Creates more anxiety, more bumps, more turbulence on the plane. And we're trying to enjoy the chicken and rice, but the bumps and the shakes of the plane put us on edge. We know something is about to happen. Each bump carries with it the possibility that something is wrong and the plane might be going down. And so Friedman proposes in these moments of chronic anxiety, strength and courage and grit are conveyed to the anxious through the presence of certain type of people. Again, what he calls well-differentiated leaders. He puts it this way. This is someone who has clarity about his or her own life goals, and therefore someone less likely to become lost in the anxious emotional process swirling about. I mean, someone who can separate while still remaining connected, and therefore can maintain a modifying, non-anxious, and sometimes challenging presence. So personally, I have been an anxious flyer for years. I've asked friends to explain to me what turbulence is so that when I'm on a plane and I feel a bump, I can talk myself through the turbulence. But it doesn't help. It doesn't help me at all. I can't talk myself down. But what is helpful for me is when I'm on a plane and there's turbulence to look to the flight attendants. I was saying stewards before, which I guess is not PC. Sarah's shaking her head at me. But I look to a flight attendant to see their response, or hopefully their non-response. Because these are people who have flown on planes significantly more than I have. And they know the nature of each one of these bumps, each bit of turbulence. They can place it in a larger story, and they convey a non-anxious presence, which puts my anxiety down. And so I've thought to myself, who are our cultural flight attendants? Who can be people of a non-anxious presence? People not hooked up to a digital nervous system. Now, it doesn't have to be this, but one place I thought were our elders. Intergenerational relationships is an underutilized resource, I think, for many of us, still trying to figure out what the nature of life is. And I like the image that James Houston, who was the founding principal at Regent College and a friend of Dave Friedrich's, right? You guys are buddies? Yeah. He has this image of elders in his book, A Vision for the Aging Church. And he's differentiating. This is not just the elderly, any person who's lived to a certain age, but men and women who carry a moral and spiritual authority as they have taken on the challenge of their own particular life, aging well with honor. People who have wisdom, love, and humility, and who can offer a longer perspective on our present moment. So Houston refers to them as something as a curriculum, a living curriculum of living life well with God and neighbor. The countenance, the presence of a spiritually mature Christian, best advertises the curriculum for further training. When we see the marks of love, joy, and peace on the face of a Christian elder, we want to enroll there as both a student and a friend. There's definitely more to say about that. But finally, I want to add, the third thing is to go for a walk. And that is most of what I want to say on this part. Go for a walk. Leave your phone at home and go for a walk with a friend. Walk together or walk by yourself. Learn to know the place where you live or the place where you happen to be. So we've covered a lot of ground tonight. That's it for the go for a walk. Just go do it. We've covered a lot of ground. There's a whole lot more ground to cover. So I'm putting the floor open. You're free to leave if you need to, if you want to get another cookie, if you want to get more tea. But let's have a conversation about how y'all feel about your phones, how you're living well or not so well with your technology. But yeah, the floor is open, but you're also free to go whenever you need to. Heather. I do it when there's stuff to do, like give my daughter a bath. I'm like, hold on. David Brooks has a great thing to say about moral formation. And, yeah, he does. He's worth reading, but not when your three-year-old daughter is taking a bath. Which is often uncomfortable. Yeah, I find it uncomfortable. So, yeah, I wanted to talk about this. A part of the reason why I wanted to talk about this is because I wanted to read and think more about my own phone use. I have a phone in my pocket. And I've realized I really like Josue's image of the lordship of the iPhone over all of life, because it has an answer to every problem, or most problems I seem to have, whether they're things I'm actually aware of or unaware of that I'm, you know, struggling with or want resolved. And it can just take over, like, yeah, really, really quickly.
Just, did you come across any ideas for how to fight back against the
addictive nature of apps? Yeah, so Dopamine Labs actually makes an app to help you get off your apps. I forget what it's called, but so like you listen to these guys or read these guys. They put out a biweekly newsletter, which is on persuasive design. So every other week, I get a little PDF from them, and I don't always read it, but sometimes you read it and you're like, "Wow, I'm so glad the good guys have this," because they come across as people with a moral compass and wanting to help and wanting. But then I'm like, I don't actually think they're the good guys. Like, or, you know, I think, so, I mean, I don't know. I don't use a lot of apps. I only have a couple apps. And I'm not trying to moralize or say all app use is bad. But I think the first step is realizing why we're on our phone as much as we are. And then go from there. Yeah, Adam, do you want to?
Just a comment. I heard maybe a month or two ago a tech blogger say that we reached peak screen time because more and more companies are realizing this is a problem and they're actually doing something about it. So I think it's a new iOS 13, I don't know, has like all these ways to track your usage and kind of limit it. And tech companies are seeing that the general public doesn't want to be on their phones all the time. So I think it depends on the screen.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, we'll totally see where it goes. Like, I know I can talk all day long in front of people about why phones aren't great, and then I can find myself on my phone when I shouldn't be. You know? Like, there's a, I think a lot of people want to not be on their phone. But I mean, this is part of the human predicament, wanting to do the the things we don't do, but doing the things we wish we didn't do. So it's tricky, and it's hard not to, as I kept reading, it's hard not to just see these sort of big tech companies as just evil, and they'll tell you whatever they want to tell you to your face, but, or in their...
And now they know that what we want to hear is going
to help. Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, it was just really interesting. Earlier in the term, I played this little Sherry Turkle talk for a group of students here, and we talked about it, and it was right as the Cambridge Analytica stuff was hitting. And one of the guys who was here was like, I think things are really going to change because of this. I think people are going to be... Like, he was like, I think she's dated herself. I mean, it was like a four-year-old talk anyway, but he was like, I think she's dated herself because I think it's going to change because of this. But since then, Facebook has posted, like, its largest earnings ever. So it's not as though, and I don't keep my finger on the pulse as much as everyone else. I'm just curious what it's going to be. And I mean, Facebook... These larger companies just sort of acquire all these other apps. So even if you're not like on Facebook, your data can still be going to them via your use of whatever. I don't even know all the things Facebook owns, but yeah. Yes, sir. I don't know your name.
Oh, John.
Hi, John.
I'm here. Thank you. This peak screen thing is interesting. The happiness effect. To what extent can we date that from the Telegraph? Moving slowly forward to the present and the increase of technologies. And then, are we racing toward a parabolic curve at a certain point where we all cannot keep up or fall off?
Can you say more about what the parabolic curve is? I'm not familiar
okay.
with that to Earth.
Well, the parabolic curve is when it goes up so high that it reaches vertical, okay, in terms of it takes a long time to get there mathematically,
yeah.
and then it piles up in itself,
yeah.
or just speeding down the track to the point you lose control.
Yeah.
In other words, if you look at the huge impact the telegraph had and the phonograph and radio
yeah.
and television and social media, and you look at the whole progress, where you're profiling for me and this peak screen, mm-hmm. my curiosity
yeah.
as well. Is there, how can society pull that back at all, apart from the gospel?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It was interesting. So Friedrichs' book is 2 years old. I think it's Oxford University Press. And so it's 2 years old. So, I mean, it's so crazy how quickly things even in this book felt dated, but she interviewed a lot of young people that are aware of all this, like aware of the negative consequences. And so some were just beginning to buy dumb phones, quote unquote dumb phones again. But I have no idea how to answer the question on what do we need to do, culturally. I mean, in some sense, when you use a piece of technology, even when you're sort of very deliberate, you know, I want to present, think of myself as someone who uses his phone very deliberately and doesn't want to let it intrude, but I'm still buying into some of the ideas that are implicit within it. I'm still using it on its terms. You know, if I use my smartphone for a hammer, I'm using it on my own terms, but when I use it as a phone, I'm using it on their terms, so it's like an acceptance of that. But, I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know how to answer. Because people are either, you know, it's going to move to us merging with the internet, this transhumanism thing where we're on the cusp of being eternal. And then, or other people are like, it's all going to crash. ISIS, like, because it's also, I mean, these are fragile systems. Like, it doesn't take, you know, like, it doesn't take much for systems to break down. And, what sort of people have we become in the process? And if, you know, we get a cyber attack that sort of makes all of our... I don't even understand how these things work. But, like, it's not as though they're not fragile and they're not going to break. So then what's going to happen then? Is this post-apocalyptic kind of... Yeah.
Transhuman is the next step.
Yeah.
Of this speed.
Yeah, I think that's what I was going to say. I think some people see it going... doom and gloom, some people is like onward and upward, into the Matrix and
and with all the economic power behind.
Yeah, which is for rich people. Yeah, I mean, it's a rich person thing. But yeah, I don't know how to answer that question.
I know there's a startup company that creates a cell phone that like tethers to your smartphone, so you can put your smartphone away, but still have some of the things that might make you feel anxious, like getting an emergency call from a husband or your wife. Or you could check your calendar. Because people, like you mentioned, the alarm clock. People use their phones for calendars. And they're afraid they might miss something that they scheduled in their phone. When you don't feel like you need all the apps, you can just take the other phone, so you have two phones. And then you have security knowing you can get like an emergency call, and then you can check it out. I thought that was one cool product that I haven't tried, but I heard there was a huge demand for it, but they couldn't keep up with the demand. Mm. But the question I had was, in Andy Crouch's book, The TechWise Family, he had like a rundown on like fasting, not fasting, but...
Yeah, digital fast.
1 hour a day.
1 day a week and 1 week a year.
Have you tried that?
Yes.
Can you explain how it went for you?
Let's see, did Mary already leave? There's someone here who's inadvertently doing the week a year, right now. To be honest, I haven't done a full week, since reading the book, but I do have times where I wake up in the morning and my phone's in a different room, cause I need time to myself, because the presence of my phone means when I have, you know, let's say I'm reading my Bible and I have some question about something that I read. It's like, oh, let me just grab my phone and figure it. But then I'm on my phone and it's like, well, let me check my email too, like while I'm here. And then it's like, oh, well, let me see what the news is. What happened while I was asleep? And then it's like 45 minutes later. I try to build time in where I'm not on my phone, or I just literally put it in another room. So the hour a day and the day a week one isn't as hard for me, but the week a year I haven't done. I went to Holland, earlier this year for 8 days and I wanted to leave my phone, but I brought it because we used it to get to our B&B and,
To connect to Wi-Fi.
And we also FaceTime our kids who are back here in the States.
I think what we've actually found to be hardest, though, is that we haven't really done it because we don't take like a week-long vacation.
Yeah.
But that I can imagine doing that. I think the day a week is the hardest. The hour a day, and he says this in the book. You know, like have your charging station where everybody in the family puts their devices in one spot, and they all go in there at dinner time, and then. Take an hour for dinner, do dishes together, whatever. Like, there aren't any phones, iPads, laptops, whatever. Nothing's involved. There's your hour a day doing something together. That is doable. But the day a week, I don't think that.
We're not perfect with, no, not for sure. Especially because I use my phone, like, it's usually on the day off, it's like, oh, I should call my mom, because I haven't called my mom all week. So I struggle with it, yeah. But
Just a comment on that. I think it's really challenging. I did a lecture a while back on Sabbath, and the idea of Sabbath and actually observing Sabbath, and one of the things that came up in a lot of the things I read is this idea of things were time outside of time. We're so bound to time, whether it's the wearing a watch or the clock on our phone or the alarms or the have to be someplace by 3 or have to be someplace by 6 or only have an hour to do this. And the idea of really deliberately practicing Sabbath, and part of the gift of that is this detachment from earthly time and attachment to God's time, in a way. And so I think that any kind of deliberate practice of Sabbath probably should include the absence of technology for the most part. And it does, it's very difficult for me to do that. But when I do feel like I experience time very differently. And I am able to, especially if I'm doing something creative or sitting and reading a book, I really can get taken in by it in a way that I can't if my phone isn't with me. I think there's a connection with actual practice of Sabbath, not just the Sabbath from the front.
Yeah, Marty.
Because I go on vacation to a place where we have no internet. And I have a smartphone that does not. So he goes, however long we're there, he's doesn't do email, doesn't do anything like that. And the trouble with that is when he comes home, there's this massive number of emails. We're none of us on social media, any social media, but then there's massive emails. Mm-hmm. If I go to this cafe, then I'll only catch up on the emails. But we did, for example, this last a month ago, we were up there for a few days in Vermont, and my brother had a heart attack, and I didn't find out for quite a while. People were calling my cell phone, but I don't have cell phone access there, and emailing me and texting me, and I just didn't get it. But eventually, my sister called one of my sons, and he knew the phone. We had a landline. And then I was able to call my brother and talk to him. But you know, that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of thing to sort of worry about. What if something happens to my
character?
But I often think, gosh, we went forever without this stuff. We managed, you know.
Yeah. One of the things Crouch does is when he does his week vacation is he puts an auto response email that says, I will not, if you, when I come back from vacation, I will not read any of the emails that were sent to me this last week. So if you need me, resend your email on this date and I will get it. So it's warning you, when I come back, I'm not going to sort through 2,000 emails. I'm going to start fresh. So yeah, Sarah.
On that note, I want to say, I think that is profoundly helpful advice, because I think the reason we struggle to detach is we feel like we're going to be punished the next day. Because I didn't keep up, and now it's even harder. And that's sort of the cultural force, whether it's a family culture or a work culture or the baby.
Yeah, I don't think I read it, but Friedis says, Friedis says in her book, The Happiness Effect, she says, we're all doctors and the president now. And she said, because 69% of the students responded yes to always needing to be on call. People have this impression. So there was a previous time where only doctors were on call 24/7, or the president was on call 24/7. She says now everyone is on call 24/7. I just like that. We're all doctors and the president now. Yeah. Aaron?
Yeah, Josh, I'm curious about, I've created a lot of research for this. Have you looked into this in non-Western cultures? Because when I saw the title for this, an image I saw some years ago sprang to mind. I think Time or something. There was these yak herders in the Himalayas, and you know, gorgeous scenery and And at first I couldn't see what they were doing, but then I looked closer and they were all glued to their smartphones, like in front of these, you know, tourist mountains. And I'm nearsighted, so I actually like checked twice. Seeing right. And I just couldn't believe it. I didn't even know they had cell phone service there.
Yeah.
So when I remember that I wonder like how much are they talking about this, especially maybe more.
Yeah, I don't totally know. I do know, like if you know, like hashtags on Twitter, like they always are ranking what the most common hashtags are, and they're not often in English. A lot of times you see Arabic, or other languages. So I think, you know, Twitter is not just an English speaking or French or, kind of Western thing. People the world over, are using social media. So, but I don't really, I don't know. You know, so yeah, Ben.
Speaking of the Neil Postman's idea, like the idea embedded in the technology, and to me, I think another one is I love your point about being in two places at one time. Another one I think is that any information I could possibly need is accessible.
Yeah.
And that means I don't have to know anything important because I can always access it.
Yeah.
And it also means I can access any number of unimportant things just on a whim.
Yeah.
For no particular reason at all.
Yeah, yeah.
That to me is really troubling, this idea that I don't have to find that out.
I'll just check it when I'm there. I'll just,
or whatever it is,
fill in the blank.
In terms of what that does to a person's competence,
self-sufficiency. Yeah, yeah. Well, it trivializes, like, yeah, what you need to know. Like, Danny Burbeck told me that I have the impulse for some random insignificant fact that I want to know, and I'm going to Google it, to wait 5 minutes and then decide if you really want to know it. And I was like, who are you, Danny Burbeck, to tell me, you know? But then I did it, and I found that I just wasn't, you know, randomly, you know, like looking up, like, oh, how many copies did Chance the Rapper's last album sell? Like, it just doesn't.
What's the third verse to that song? Yeah. Steely Dan.
Yeah, yeah, right. Oh, and who was their bass player? The guy with the hair, you know? Like, no, I've just found it because I think it pulls me into, like, for me, it pulls me into insignificant things, like,
right, yeah.
Things that just don't matter. But yeah, Mark.
I was born in 1995, but all my siblings are born in the 80s, and I still remember, like, how they would go out, like, back in the 2000s, like, in the last decade and a half, and, like, you know, they would, like, literally go out, they would go, like, to, like, different churches, get, like, a huge crowd together, and just go, like, you know, like, a caravan of cars, go to, like, San Francisco or Santa Cruz or, like, out to some forest and out, so, you know, just to LA, wherever. And nowadays, like, I struggle with trying to get organized people together and, like, you know, go out as a group. Like, even though it's a lot easier to organize people, you know, today than it is a decade or decade and a half ago, it's a lot harder to actually get those people to come.
Yeah.
Like, all right, let's go. Let's take a good trip to San Francisco. And
yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, yeah, like, you know, they're probably just stuck on their phones or, you know, on their computers. So my question is, how do I get my generation, this is fourth one, in the 1990s to turn off, tune out, and go out?
Yeah. That is a great question. If people have any thoughts on that, anybody?
I don't know, but I know that there is, like, a strange glorification of being imperfect now. Like, a lot of the media, like, memes that are created are really centered around how much people love being at home and doing nothing and eating Doritos.
Yeah.
But then they're sitting at home doing that, making memes, but they're not interacting with anybody. It's like self-perpetuating.
Yeah, yeah. Wait, did you?
I feel like some of it's FOMO, fear of missing out.
Yeah.
And I wonder if those are kind of connected in that, like, it's, I want to wait and see if something else better is going to come along.
Yeah.
So it's the projection of, like, ooh, like, is this the best option? And I'm going to not go because then I need to keep it open to see if something else is going to pop up. And then I also wonder if our connectedness, and there's some research to suggest that it's actually decreasing our ability to have interactive conversations because I don't want to upset you. And I don't like conflict, so I'm just going to go and do this on my phone where I can shout at you or say whatever I want to say without having to deal with the fallout. And so we actually end up becoming less human in particular.
Well, and our culture isn't conducive to slowing down. Our jobs, our pace, the lives that we live, it's not conducive to slowing down. And so it's like, you know, if I start drinking alcohol and I get really dizzy, well, how do I make that dizziness go away? Drink more alcohol. get more accustomed to it, make the dizziness go away. And I feel like that's, we're creating technology to help us keep up with a pace that we were never designed to keep up with. Mm. So it just kind of goes back to this, we gotta stop, like we gotta rest, and it's gonna be uncomfortable and awkward, and we're gonna have to face some stuff. But like, what I'm a youth pastor, and so I'm, if the parents of my students don't see this, then my students are screwed. Mm-hmm. Because they're looking to their parents, and their parents mm-hmm. are setting outlandish paces. Their parents mm-hmm. are setting their schedules. And so blame the parents, and then blame the parents of the parents, and then, there's so many people to blame.
Yeah, let's do that. Who does somebody want to blame? No. Is there anyone who hasn't spoken yet? Yeah, good.
So kind of speaking about FOMO, a couple of years ago there was a TED Talk, I forget who it was, and he was talking about capitalism. And he said the kind of great deception of capitalism is just thinking you can find the perfect thing. But there's not one marinara sauce, there are 18 kinds.
Yeah.
Because you're going to constantly be unhappy because you know that the perfect one is out there.
Yeah.
And now we have access to be in the hopeless good ones, to know everybody that's happy everywhere. And so it's kind of like a game of figuring mm-hmm. out what's the absolute best option.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're always dissatisfied. Yeah, yeah.
And anxious.
Yeah.
That makes me majorly anxious.
Yeah.
The overchoice and the over amount of information.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's paralyzing. Yeah.
So I'm a youth leader, my youth pastor, good job. So I spent a lot of time with teenagers, and I will say that one of the things is that I've been really thinking about the idea of presence and about hospitality, and creating a space where hospitality literally means creating space, mm-hmm. and creating a space where they fully feel loved and are loved and for who they are as teenagers mm-hmm. anyway. And I think that we can all experience that. So when they experience a place where they are loved where they are and for who they are, it gives them a taste of what it can be like. And so I would so the idea of hospitality, I think, is something that I'm trying to build into our youth program a little bit more of this idea of presence. And, but as a little glimmer of hope that I've seen a lot of my students actually taking breaks from some of their apps. This one app called Snapchat, which I can't figure it out. But they're actually, of their own volition, they are taking breaks from this, which is, to me, really encouraging that they're starting to take a step back and look around and say, maybe this isn't so healthy. And I think it does come back to the parents, but also what is modeled to them. To be honest, like, we took them on a retreat one weekend and we were practicing spiritual disciplines, and we gave them 10 minutes of solitude, total silence, by themselves. They loved it. The leaders have the hardest time, to be honest. Like, we were like, oh my gosh, this is stressful. So it's really interesting. And I've also seen that, like, it kind of ruins their idea of friendship, where you think you can be friends with 900 people and you can't. And so, and by way of practical advice, there's a really simple thing you can do with your phone. You can turn it to black and white. And it takes away the red or the different colors. And I did it for a while, and it gave me a headache at first, because I think I was super addicted. But you can Google how to turn your phone to black and white, and it cuts the red, the red little indicator. And I found that it worked really well. So.
Yeah, well, actually, maybe other people should talk. But yes.
It's funny. We challenged each other, my wife and I, to drop Facebook for a month. And we dropped it quick, but the scary thing was once I started looking after that month, how quick it came back.
Yeah.
And it was almost like a long-lost friend. where have you been? And
what I noticed, too, is that people miss that, like, there were a lot of people pulling us back in, and also our church and the Christian school we have the kids at, they were not required, but a lot of our updates come through
we can't
it's frustrating. In order to be up to the speed on events and things like that, you pretty much have to use Facebook, and that's very frustrating.
We knew it was a brutal situation with the cell phone. When our kid, our 14-year-old, her best friend are deathly quiet, they're giggling, they're sitting like we are right now, texting each other.
Talk
to each other.
Yeah, that's why you're here, hanging out.
Yeah, Sherry Turkle's other book, she's the one with the Reclaiming Conversation book. Her previous book is called Alone Together, which I haven't read, but it describes that.
They all stand around in circles of five, texting each other.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I just mentioned studies that are connected to cell phone use, and one of the ones that I thought was most interesting was rates of premarital sex and teen pregnancy, at least in Japan and Northern Ireland, had dropped significantly, and people were like, "This is great! Kids aren't making these stupid choices. You know, this is a wonderful thing." Until the assumption, like the correlation, is it's because they're just sitting in their room. It's not just that they're not having sex and doing, you know, making stupid choices. They're just sitting in their room on their phone. Like, they're not going out at all. And so there's a sense where you read it or you hear it, it's like, oh, this is great. How, you know, reversing or changing a culture. And it's like, actually not really. It's,
any studies on like the on what's happened to the people, like the rejection feelings of being in the room with somebody who won't put their phone down, or being the child of a parent who's addicted to their phones? Have they done any kind of
Sherry Turkle's book talks about that. There was a recent article in the Atlantic on it, and I mean, it does, it seems like a phenomenon that I mean, it projects dismissiveness or disdain, and so it's what children kind of internalize. Children want eye contact and presence, it's not good. I'm trying to think any more details on that, but yeah, Sarah.
I just wanted to maybe talk together more about Cedia and. So there's so much to blame in all of this, but it does seem like a way forward is to start to recognize what love is asking of us, day in and day out. And I just wondered, for you, my husband, other people in the room, like how are you responding to the demands of love? In hard ways, because I don't know, it just strikes me that it's like we have to do even the preliminary step of realizing that love asks something of us, and then even to see what we're being asked that we're totally even missing, that we're being asked something before we then respond. You know, like sitting side by side texting, maybe love is asking for eye contact instead of screen contact. I don't know, but how to start thinking in those terms a little bit. It seems to me like that's a way to sort of break the blame cycle too, because at some point I have to say, well, no matter what got me here, love is asking something.
Yeah.
I can choose if and how I will respond to it.
I've spoken a lot. I can talk. Does anyone else want to say anything? Or? Yeah. Can you remind me of your name again? I'm sorry.
Susan.
Susan, yeah.
So media ecology is a ton of fun, and just to get addicted to that in and of itself. And I definitely got addicted. There are some really good books I've read. So for anyone who is interested in this, the book The Shallow by Nicholas Carr, I highly recommend that. And then T. David Gordon at Grove City College is doing a lot of work on this subject. And like I told you about this one second.
Yeah, Ben?
Just wondering whether
say if we are the righteous one person in the cafe that isn't looking at their phone, and everybody else is looking at their phone, and the question is, what does love demand? I don't know. I mean, very often we're not the righteous one, but say we are, do we have to be willing to just, like, butt into people's virtual experiences and, like, start talking to someone even though this person doesn't want to make eye contact with me? What other way is there going to be to make personal contact with somebody unless we are incredibly disruptive? I mean, because they're not going to... It's never going to be comfortable. I mean, I don't mean being incredibly... I don't mean this in a gratuitously obnoxious way, but just like sooner or later, if you're going to have a conversation with somebody, you're going to have to be the one to interrupt their virtual experience. I mean, hey, what are you doing there? What are you? And of course, you're going to be the person that everyone thinks is obnoxious. In the moment, I guess. I think I'm often just like totally paralyzed by this. It's like I couldn't possibly interrupt somebody. They're doing something so important there, and it's not true most of the time.
This reminds me of actually Anna went to Vancouver to go to Regent for class, and she told me how she walked to class every day, and her goal was to say hello to everybody she passed. But everybody she passed was on their phone as they're walking. She still did it.
Why are you saying hi to me?
Yeah. So yeah, maybe we need to
social experiments.
Because just in the last 3 or 4 years, I've been mostly living in New York City and taking the public transportation, which is the subway. And in the subway, you have an intersection of all kinds of people and nations. But the one thing that we see so far is almost, say, like 80% is looking on their phone. And one thing to like help that is, actually, this is something that our church practices, just to be responsive and to like around it. So sometimes it hasn't even been in our sermon. So like when we're riding the subway even the act of if you don't have your cell phone, you're really present. And what really kind of disrupts and shocks people out of their phone is just being really human. Like if someone comes and begging for money, and you just respond kindly, everyone just can play this song. Mm-hmm. Or one time, and just put your phone down a little bit, and just notice. Mm-hmm. Or just like an act of present kindness. And then another thing too is, if you're sitting there and everyone's on their phone, and a lot of times, like, if someone's like older, handicapped, and they come on the subway, a lot of people don't get up. Like, they don't leave their seat. Mm-hmm. But if you actually do that, it causes people to just stop and just notice. Or if something I noticed too is smiling, if my face is smiling and there are children in the subway who just take a commute back and forth to school, and you're just smiling at them, like, people actually who are sitting by them and their parents will just be like, oh, and just kind of stop a little bit. And it's maybe it's the same as, like, walking in Vancouver and say hi to everyone. And it's also a distraction to also be present, because sometimes you notice things, or you can just... Yeah, so noticing and makes people a little bit stop, because they think, well, at least in public transportation, people really, really want to be on their phone because you're always with strangers, and it feels really lonely here because you don't because you're spending two, because you literally spend 2 hours a day in this place, into the city and out of the city. And so when you're sitting there, a lot of times you're by yourself because you're going to work, but you're around other people. And so it feels really that feeling of loneliness. And so you want to get on your phone and just see if your friends are doing what they're doing. But I like what you said. It's okay sometimes to be in discomfort and to feel that loneliness and just to see what is around you.
Yeah, it takes like a certain amount of imagination to see those moments as opportunities as opposed to sort of inconveniences, you know, like this is an opportunity for me to choose to do something with this, you know, this time, because I do think space to reflect, I did read a fair bit on walking, and people, all these great creative, imaginative people throughout history, when they're stuck on some sort of problem, this goes back to Aristotle and up to like Wordsworth, like people would just stop what they were doing and go for a walk and sort of let it all like get out of their head for a minute and go down. And there's this Latin phrase, my pages have got all out of whack here, Salvator ambulando, which literally means it is solved by walking. Your problem is solved by walking. And so you deliberately choose not to sort of, it's not a disengagement with what's around you, but it's engaging in it like in a different way. It's just being present to actually where you are. And I found in times of like being stuck in trying to write something or stuck relationally with things, like a walk is actually a time where I go and I clear my mind, and actually it's where things emerge. Like boredom can be a place where things go on below the surface. It's uncomfortable in some ways, but these things that are rattling below are sort of deliberate, like conscious reflection, can sometimes just pop, can come up, you know? I don't know if that any of that even made sense, but like, yeah. Mary Frances?
Yeah, I was just thinking about how I wanted to make a comment about the intergenerational thing, but I was just thinking about how cell phone culture, it's an idolatry of self. Like, that's what it's feeding into, is a focus in an idolatry of self, even though it's like, oh, well, no, I have my phone here to call these people or text these people or see these pictures on Facebook. Like, it's the illusion of being about other, but it's really not. It's so much about the self. And I think when you were talking about intergenerational things, I was thinking of two examples. This doesn't specifically have to do with cell phones, but I was thinking about a time in my life in my 20s where I was in this very angsty place about the direction of my life and what I should be doing. And I have some friends who live in the area who are 20 years older than I am, and are friends and spiritual directors. And I remember going and talking to them and just coming away feeling so much more sane. And I realized that part of it was because I had been talking to all my friends about this, but all my friends in their mid-20s were dealing with the same stuff that I was. Mm-hmm. And it's helpful. It's helpful to have, and mm-hmm. necessary, I think, to have people in your life who are in the same stage of life.
Mm-hmm.
But that sort of feeds into the self, right? It's like we're all sharing each other's, the same struggle, the same angst, and having these friends that are further ahead of me in life, be like, even just the questions that they ask and the comments, it's like, well, why do you have to do that? Why do you, you know, it was just like, you know,
yeah.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
And I think of how many, can be a reactionary person, and I just think of how many times I've been in a worker's debris, and like one of us, and I was being sort of hot under the collar about something that's happening within the debris, or something that's happening with a student, and how many times Dick has said, we've dealt with this before. This is, you know, and just the gift of of perspective and experience, and where for me something can feel like, what is happening right now? This is crazy.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, this isn't actually this is the first time you've been here. It's not the first time we've been here.
Yeah, yeah.
And
and just the gift of that, that the chronic anxiety piece. But I think even to Sarah's question about how do we, even the idea of the hard work of loving, I think there's a way that the intergenerational piece can help us with that. Because there's a model there of generations who have done things differently and whose influences have been different. And it's that getting us out of, I think it's what walking does too. It's like, oh yeah, there's actually a whole world out here that doesn't just exist in my own head. And that sense of pulling us out of ourselves in our own kind of narrow place to show us a different way.
Yeah. I pay money to see an older person every 6 weeks. Well, now it's 6 weeks. It used to be once a month. But, we met this week, but we had also met 6 weeks prior. And I went and I explained to him one of the most difficult internal experiences I had had, kind of in my adulthood. Just a day that was set up to be a wonderful day and turned out to be a day of huge disappointment and realizing all these things about myself. And he smiled and was like, you're settling. Like, you're settling in, you're setting roots, settling, not like giving up. And so all this stuff is coming to the surface. This is really good. And I was like, no, let me start from scratch again. This was a terrible day. And he was someone who was, he provided this non-anxious presence, and he also gave me a way to reinterpret my situation, which I think was more true to the situation, because he has lived significantly longer than I have and has seen more and can help put my moment of whatever in a larger, my own life even in another context. And he's done that with parenting and with other, so I'm a believer in intergenerational relationships. Nikayla? Yeah.
Just to Sarah's question, I think it's helpful talks about the difference between advice and technology.
Yeah.
And the three things of technology should be about skill, courage, and risk, and like making those the focus of why we use our technology. But I think this is just your question of like love. Like, it takes courage, skill, and risk to do all of these things.
Yeah.
And even to, you know, to compliment somebody on something or say hi, like the courage of those things to even get our mind out of a device to, you know, how do we relate to people? Because we've always had technologies.
Yeah.
But we're in a different world now of devices. And just the building courage and skill in the way we are with people.
Yeah. Yeah, Allison? Could you speak slightly louder? Sorry.
I was thinking about you pulling in the Postman.
Yes.
In 1998. And he had an earlier book about using ourselves to that system, how technology will undermine our democracy. Positive, light reading. But it was really interesting to hear his later thoughts as well, sort of being a center. And I was also thinking a lot about your question about technology adaptation in the rural and remote areas, either Western or non-Western. But I lived and traveled in some places that were similar to what you described. And not always, but in some of those places, the access to landmines has completely sort of skipped the technology. Mm-hmm. Because it's so difficult and expensive to get landline access. But now the cell phones are providing access that was never. So
yeah.
It's not like they had a similar experience. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, well, we had the landlines and now we're going to this. It's like we had nothing and now we have something.
Yeah.
So the experience of people in those communities would be pretty different. But that doesn't mean necessarily that it's like different. I think there's probably some similarities and differences. But and some of the wonderful things is like communicating and making some emergency, not necessarily that we'd be able to get to hospital, but you know, in ways that never existed prior to the cell phones.
Yeah.
But this great picture is like a Tibetan monks who are like building their like horse festivals up on the plateau, you know, with their smartphones.
Mm-hmm.
But Facebook is actually deploying phones in some very remote areas, so people can have access to Facebook out in the
I think they have recently canceled that. But I did see a commercial. Like I said, most of these big companies don't advertise. But I did see a commercial with the drone flying in Africa. But I think they canceled that idea.
They also provide free access to Facebook in a lot of countries.
Yeah, Marty?
I was just going to make a comment on the intergenerational relationship, because it's something that I've done quite a lot of work on over the years, and just did a word study throughout the Bible, the Old and New Testament, on all the different words for different age groups. And what was fascinating is, in biblical history and in the Bible, there's just this assumption that there will be a lot of informal interaction between all ages. And and interestingly, the modeling goes in all directions. So, and I think this could be an important thing with young people, if the older people communicate that actually, yes, I'm a model for you, but you're also a model for me. Mm-hmm. And Jesus saying you can't get into the kingdom of heaven or be graded unless you become like a child. You don't know any children. You won't even know what that means. Mm-hmm. Paul says, with respect to evil, be as infants.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does that mean? If you don't know any infants, you know, infants aren't unfallen, but they are not guilty of premeditated evil. Right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things, one of my passions has been, why is it that if all of life is divided up in age-segregated groups now, why on earth do we live in the church, which is the one place where we don't have to? And there could be so much more if churches have there's nothing biblical about dividing everybody up into age-segregated groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, the biblical model is much more interaction. Again, informal interaction, not professional interaction.
Yes,
coaches and teachers and probation officers, you know, who get paid for what they do, but friendships, intergenerational friendships. And so that's something to work on, I think, in our churches, is to raise the question, why aren't we doing more to break down age separation? Why do we put all the adolescents together? This is the typical thing. Hire a youth pastor who will deal with the kids. Maybe a youth pastor could be very helpful in integrating kids with adults who care about them more than just their parents. Because kids tend to need relationships with other adults.
Yeah. One of the most difficult seasons in our life, we happened to be go to a small church where we were the youngest people by 30 years or so. So it was all older people, significantly older. And I think they didn't know what to do with us. We didn't often know what to do with them, but we really didn't have any other friends. So we were probably more open to, than they were anticipating. But the week before we left was when we came here, and we didn't know if what was going to happen at LaBrie. We had a small kid. We had this 1994 Dodge Caravan. We were driving across country. We'd been in this difficult season of unemployment and underemployment, and it felt as though this is the stupidest thing. Why are we doing this? Who knows where we're going? And Dee and Chuck, this older couple, were like, oh yeah. Like, I was trying to express all of this to them in ways that I really wanted them to be like, oh wow, this is really hard for you guys. But they were like, oh yeah. And he told a story about having more kids than we did, being older than we were, losing a job, and then packing everyone up in a smaller car with less savings and driving to a new place to start a job that they didn't know anything about. And he was like, we've been there, and look where we are now. And I was, at first, I was like, no, you don't understand. Like, I want to be the special person here. But I have thought back to how just, for them, that was just, to me, I had imbibed this narrative that no one had taught me. I have no one to blame. That just, like, life is going to work out and go, everything's going to be onward and upward. And they had lived significantly more life and had known that that is totally bogus. And maybe they never even had that impression, but you have to do things with your life if you want to get anything out of it or end up, you know, someplace other than where we were. And so their response, I mean, we after church, we'd have meals, and these people would eat so much sweets. And I just remember this mound of strawberry ice cream that he was eating while he was talking to me. And he was like, oh, yeah. Like, and he told his story. And it was like no big deal. And anyway, I've really, that has been something that has given me a lot of, I was sort of frustrated with it because I was like, why didn't you tell me this 6 months ago when I was unemployed and just every week was coming to church saying, I need a job. Can we pray that I would get a job? And, but so I don't know. I do think I've experienced, my life has been enriched by relationships with people that have lived longer and been able to put a different sort of perspective on the moment I'm living in that makes me so whatever. But yeah. So yeah, Aaron.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to one quick anecdote. This is a passion of mine as well. It's in a generation. So Marty's left is actually my favorite. I've ever attended here. But the times when I feel most alive, I felt unusually alive this week. When I looked back at the past 3 days, I had just finished a mercy ministry Bible study, and there were Ben and Sarah from my age, or Sarah's 35, Ben's from I'm 27, two older guys in the group who all met together. And the next day I went to talk to my best friend Josh, who I grew up in church with. We talked for 3 hours. And then the next day after that, I'd gone to prayer meeting with my associate pastor, Jeff, who's like 42. And some of my closest friends, and I'm like 50, 60 year old women. I actually woke up the other day and texted Marianne because I knew she was going through depression and asked her to come out. And she came out, and at that moment I felt alive. I looked back and realized those past 3 days I had cut across the entire age spectrum, gender spectrum. It's those moments that make me feel most human.
Yeah.
So, I completely agree with
my generation.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I think we're just kind of programmed that way to have like a perception of this is for older people, this is for younger people. For example, I work as a journalist and I have to write a business profile every week. So I pitched the idea of a ballroom dancing studio to open. And my editor said to me, oh, they must be catering to the older people. I went there today. It was anything but for the older people. But it's just like people have that perception. You know, there's young people, there's old people. It was kind of inspiring. Like, they tried to get me on the dance floor, I didn't. But it was just kind of cool to see. I went there earlier today. It was cool to see younger people and older people. And in a ballroom dancing setting, you have to change partners. Like, people might go and say, like, oh, I'm just going to dance with my girlfriend or whatever. So you saw younger people dancing with older people. And so that's just an example of, we just kind of have this perception, like, oh, ballroom dancing is for old people. This is for young people. Like,
yeah.
So it's just kind of, sometimes if you get out of your head with that and, like, look at different perspectives on things and like, experience things, it kind of helps.
Yeah, I agree. Anybody else? All right. Well, thank you all for coming out on a Friday night. And